Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Justin Ramsaran. Justin is the co-founder and CEO of the R Group, also the VP of Digital Health Solutions at Fukuda Denshi. Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be on. Happy to be here as well.
Excellent. Hey, so why don't we get started with the R Group? You know, would love to know what problems the company is solving in the marketplace.
Yeah, so again, health tech focused as a company, kind of derived out of an area of need and also being part of the problem, to be quite honest with you. So Fukuda Denshi and many other medical device manufacturers in the space have been innovative in the way that develop devices, but point-to-point solutions have caused a lot of fragmentation. I've been on the end of implementing those solutions and realized how many issues we were causing in the connectivity space as a whole. So our group kind of derived out of that, and in order to enable the ability for connectivity, a little more seamless, more turnkey, comprehensive solution for healthcare systems, and again, downstream providers as well. And in that process, that's kind of where we built up our product suite and started tackling the head-on problem of device connectivity, but also enabling hospitals access to their information to make better clinical decisions as a whole.
And so for the members of our audience who are not as dialed into healthcare, can you give us some insights, big picture into some of the interoperability challenges that...
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I just talked about medical device connectivity, and that's the simplest problem of all, which we still have yet to actually find a solution to in a comprehensive manner. You've got smart light bulbs, you've got smart thermostats, but these devices, as they've been built, were never built for connectivity. They were built as a utility. They help doctors, they help get information, they help us chart. But what's occurred is you've got clinicians being away from the bedside, and there's now inside of the terminal, we'll call it, but the medical records, 80% of the day taking notes and updating information, reducing what's going on at the bedside care standpoint. It comes down to the devices, right? If these things didn't have full-on capabilities and they haven't been created with that ability to connect, there's the gap, right? There's the issue in itself, and where interoperability continues to be fragmented because each solution vendor is coming out with their own proprietary connection. If you've got, you know, we won't call it the big names, but if you've got a patient monitor and a ventilator, you've got to use this specific medical device manufacturer's connectivity application, and it doesn't talk to the monitoring application. Data silos everywhere, and you continue to fragment it throughout the entire care continuum.
It's been a short while, but I know that there's been nonprofit efforts like HL7 to normalize communications. What efforts have been made with the industry stakeholders to circumvent this? And it sounds like that they really just haven't been successful as maybe some of the regulations out there would have hoped them to have been.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think HL7, we've found a way to standardize a lot of the data formats, which has been great from a development standpoint and also for the way we integrate, but it hasn't eliminated the issue of different fragmented languages or ways that they're communicating across the entire health system domain. So you've got the EMR vendors, the Epics, the Cerners, you know, large names that are out there. And if you are in the Epic platform, you can't talk to the Cerner platform, right? It's how they kind of keep their competition, but also keep the information within these own silos as well. What's been interesting, I could note, is in the last 6 to 8 months, there has been some qualifications of the industry understanding that we have to share the information a little more unanimously. There's a new thing known as TEFCA, and another one known as QHIN. And the shortened version is those are qualified health integrated networks that are now supposed to be a part of like a trusted exchange framework that says, hey, if you've got Epic or you've got Cerner and you've got HL7 or FHIR, whatever it may be, you must share that, right? In order to help support the growth of our system and enable better patient care, either join on board or you'll be left behind. that comes from a downstream of areas too, where it will start to impact medical device manufacturers needing to be more data oriented and be able to have more open architectures in the ways that they communicate the information.
So I encourage you, you're welcome to go in any level of technical detail that you'd like, but enter our group. Would love to know your approaches and how you're taking advantage of this mandate to connect devices.
So for us, we focused originally just on that process of device connectivity being, call it our low-hanging fruit. But the bigger thing we've seen in the last few years, we won't get on the buzzwords of AI per se, but we understand that that's a driving paradigm. Everyone is now creating new data systems, creating new AI applications, AI devices. But inherently, if you're adding these in, you're also creating more fragmentation because we now have to use this AI application that only works with this device or only will work with this system. So we kind of said, let's flip it on its head, right? We're not going to be in the game of AI, but we're going to be focused on powering the AI systems with data. A lot of these healthcare systems, device manufacturers, they have this data, but there's too much of it now. It's unstructured and it hasn't found a way to be facilitated to be used for upstream applications. So, kind of entering to the R group perspective, we're like, okay, if we can find a way to be the best at structuring information, giving healthcare access and the hospitals access to their own data to make their own clinical decisions, reduce the friction of point-to-point solutions. They now have their own platform there. Now we can say, let's power what goes on in the AI world, right? Garbage in, garbage out. You don't have good data, you're not going to have good AI at the end of the day. And that's the approach that we're taking with it. So we've developed what our flagship product is known as Health Mosaic, and that is essentially supposed to be a turnkey comprehensive solution, handles a lot of the connectivity issues, but gives that data enablement for data streams, data pipes for AI applications to grow, where we'll start to launch what we'll consider our own marketplace here very soon to build and grow more devices out on that and applications.
Fantastic. What was the genesis behind the R group? How'd you guys get started, and how'd you know that this was the path that you wanted to follow?
Like every, I would say, tech company, you start off with services, right? We were kind of an operationalized software dev house, picking up the odd job projects. And again, just I would say my little over a decade experience in med tech itself and seeing that issue, right? Again, we chop shop some software, we made some great applications, but still kept coming back to this three-way point where I'm sitting in a hospital conversation. I've got a med device vendor, I've got IT, and then I've got me as the sales engineer at one point. Having to have, 8 month long meetings to connect one single modality. And that, dies on the vine, right? This is where we don't get things, out the gate. Things aren't being able to move forward or progress inside that health system. And that kind of sparked where we went from, let's change this and see if we can take the applications we're building for healthcare instead of being services and actually make a product that can make some bigger impact outside of us.
Great. And if even a further step back, we mentioned your co-founder, musician, but you have professional services as well. Have you always been an entrepreneur, or was there a defining moment when you realized that you wanted to start creating on your own terms?
So I would say to an extent, definitely have been. It's probably my second or third startup. Third one, actually. Third one. So two before were cybersecurity ones. And they were out of college. My co-founder, I've known, funny enough, since we were in eighth grade. So we've been best of friends. He's always been there as well. We've been through many different concept product ideas. Some have worked, some haven't. But we, found the way to kind of pivot along those areas to say, what can we do to add and deliver value, up the chain and kind of create a better system? I would say naturally just always been trying and tinkering with new things. But it's always been a calling for me to try and build and do something different out of the normal domain.
And what were the outcomes of those earlier companies that you started?
Each one actually helped fund to where we're at now, to be quite honest with you. So very first one was an at-home cybersecurity product to help, protect your home network. Then we pivoted into a space of medical device security. And then naturally that ended up into the med tech space and med devices as a whole. And again, every couple bucks we made along the way, we're like, let's pocket it for the next one, right? We don't need it yet, but something's gonna happen. And luckily enough, knock on wood, we've been able to bootstrap, to where we're at for the last 2 to 3 years just with innovation and just pure grit, the true entrepreneurship way, to get us there.
Fantastic. So I have to imagine that you've accumulated a whole host of experience over the years, perhaps just as important of what to do, but also what not to do. What are some of the key takeaways you think our audience would find valuable in their own entrepreneurial pursuits?
Find that product market fit, right? Find a niche solution and something that seems very antiquated or boring as a legacy system and make it better, right? I think that's the big thing we learned, in the simplest of ways. These devices have been around. It is a tough problem to solve. We won't call it an easy one, but because it's old, legacy, antiquated approaches, we said there's got to be a way that we can make a better approach to it and define that, right? And we defined that, I think, earlier in our process from our prior two or three startups. And we said this is a big problem with a niche solution that we can tackle. And that's where we started to narrow in on that very heavily in this last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit two key variables in the success formula, and that's one, it can be easier to take a market than to make it. And if
Correct.
you familiarize yourself with it intimately, you put yourself in a great position in order to get uptake. The other one is, and we don't hear this as often, but it's been discussed on a number of episodes, this idea of starting with professional services to finance the company operations as you get going. I wholeheartedly support the concept, and it gives you a whole host of variables, one of them being the ability to bootstrap until you're in a position where you're satisfied it makes sense to take on financing. Earlier we talked about your other role, VP Digital Health Solutions at Nakoda Denshi. Would love to know the relationship to your
So I'll to them. So they were the ones, let's see, it was probably my second job out of college. They took a huge risk on me. I was call myself a young buck. I was about 23 or 24. And they said, hey, we've got all these issues. You want to do something interesting and, maybe make a couple of dollars along the way. And that was essentially it. Come to find out, again, Fukuda Denshi being, again, worth about $1 billion a year. Overall in their Japanese market and here stateside as well, where they do a lot of their support. There's four big branches of it, and got the opportunity to build and advance what we did here in the US, which translated to me working with our heads of R&D at the headquarters in Japan in the last 7 years, being able to make direct impact. So from product innovation to what we do for digital health in our market here, and being able to move rapidly. The role has been very dynamic. They've looked at me being a thought leader for us as a whole, as a company. We may not be going, as big with some of the larger head-to-heads, the Philips, the GEs out there. But we have the ability to be very nimble, from a thought-provoking standpoint. We're moving at the speed of thought. And again, being able to work from that perspective gets me a lot of exposure, has allowed me to develop and build a better product on the outside that we, dynamically are working to help innovate the industry as a whole. So that's truly it, right? It's being able to help scale the R&D side, but getting that exposure from multiple facets along the way.
So it sounds like it's a positive experience, and that you've also had alignment philosophically on how you see the market, which I presume we'd agree is an asset because it enables you to move fast. That said, healthcare is a really conservative market. How do you find that having a relationship with a larger brand name has proven to be invaluable, and for either was opening doors or facilitating conversations that maybe not wouldn't otherwise take place?
I think so, right? I would say having a name behind you does help support it, but I think the true thing is understanding what's actually happening inside of the healthcare systems. And that to me, I think, is the exposure and experience that's helped us be dynamic. We're not just coming with a SaaS solution. We're not just focused on SaaS selling. That's just software as in itself. And then we're not just talking about a medical device that's capitally expensive, right? That's here are these features, here are these benefits, but rather being able to understand what the true data strategy is for those facilities and being able to have a dialogue where you're bringing in the true shareholders and stakeholders. It's not just the clinical person, it's not just the CIO or CFO, it's everyone at the table. We're talking to the guys that are in the basement, the biomed guys who work with the devices, the IT guys that get burnt out because they have to operate and manage these, and then the top levels to help them understand, here's your disconnect. Here's how you increase the ROI without having to actively always reduce FTEs and operationalize a better process and create that operational efficiency. So names help, never going to say no to that. But I think really and truly getting entrenched into the customer cycle and the ecosystem of what's occurring is what's really provided the most value, being able to see it from all angles. Again, top down, bottom up. And again, from the technical side, definitely helps amplify that as well.
Got it. Well, we've been fortunate to have a whole host of health and med tech entrepreneurs on the podcast. And definitely one of the themes that has come out of it is that this is a more conservative industry. Sales cycles can be longer. It's without revealing any trade secrets, though. I'd love to know, what's been your approach to getting consensus among, knowing that there's so many. And that the stakes are higher, given dealing with patient care.
Our biggest secret, I would say, I think it's the simplest one that's the easy to be shared, is helping those projects go from a data project to a data strategy. That has been the best approach we've taken. There's low-hanging fruit that we've understood that there are things that have just been left because, again, other players in the space haven't had time. It's not the highest thing on their docket to help them connect, one or two devices, let's say, or handle another project that was there. And that came from our professional services side, where we were going and saying, hey, like, we can do this, right? Half the price, half the team, you get it up and running quicker time. That started building, again, and stair-stepping the approach we had, where we're like, if this was the way that we did this from, that standpoint of development, this is the same approach we should be taking and holding our customers' hands to explain and understand what the entire, data play is going to be. And that for us has been, I would say, the best way to help reduce some of the sales cycle time, but also increase our ability to scale and gather customers. It's changing just that paradigm of, oh, we're going to do one piece of it. No, let's understand what the entire goal is, and let's take you through that and develop a process that gets you from A to B and helps you future proof rather than trying to upsell you something in the next 3 to 4 years again.
Makes good sense. So let's continue on that theme. So every company is going to devote some amount of time to budgeting. There's decisions that need to be made around product development and sales and marketing. Would love to know your perspective on how you think about capital allocation. Knowing that you're operating in the early stage, but that you're also working with some pretty demanding clients given the industry.
Yeah, and I'll say it, right? It's been customer success, right? That has been the number one focus we have leaned in on. I think from my background, my technical co-founder and our team as a whole, we have guys have been at Dell, guys have been at Boomi, companies have IPO'd, SaaS backgrounds and all. And I never noticed it until I heard again the term pop up in the last few years. We've got a customer success team. I'm like, is that support? They said, no, it's not support. It's about the enablement and adoption of the solution. And that simple concept, I think, is what blew it out of the water for us, where we're like, this is the problem, right? Is you deploy a solution, medical device, or even again, a software application for healthcare, and you can't just come in and deploy something in 90 days, support it for 90 days, and then set it and forget it. Healthcare is dynamic. You've got to find a way to be iterative on it. So that's what we've leaned in on in order to help us keep the support costs and be able to handle our finances as well, but also keep the customer retention with some upselling capabilities along the way. Is if you're going to use that solution, right, we've done a good job of enabling you to understand it and you've adopted it into your workflow. There's a level of stickiness there. It gets really hard to take it out at that point because it's either being used to its fullest capacity or it is one of the best products at that point that's continually being built upon from there.
So it's a brilliant explanation, and I think you hit on a bunch of things. In fact, you dovetail into what was going to be my next set of questions. But before I get off customer success, would love a little bit in the weeds, but tactically, would love to know whether or not you're paying them bonuses for retention or expansion.
Absolutely, right? You got to reward them, right? Again, we've got to reward the team. And hey, we're a startup, so we're all about giving out, cool swag. So I think we try to take the time to make some nice, cool, customized gear for our team along the way. Not just your quarter zips and, vests, but we do make some fun little stuff for everybody, when they get a big win or, we get a new expansion in that aspect. So try to balance it, but we do definitely try to incentivize our team to do that.
Great. And so then let's come back to performance metrics. Any in particular that you find your C-suite gravitates towards when assessing performance?
Yeah, I think we do look at our CSAT scoring, and then just to count health when we kind of focus on it. We've been trying to make sure and create metrics that are not so heavily driven on making sure you need to meet them as the requirement, but making sure that it's just following up. And that has been, I think, the simplest one of, hey, don't let a customer sit for more than 48 hours on a response, right? If you have the answer, go ahead and follow up right away. If you don't have the answer, at least let them know you'll get back to them, right? Or CC somebody, add somebody, find a route to let the customer know, hey, we're taking an approach to this and we care about the problem or the situation at hand because you've brought it to us. And that's been our simplest metric is, hey, how quick is your response time, if you want to say, on being able to give a valuable provided answer. And we don't need a customer support answer of, hey, we'll reach back out to you in 24 hours when we have something. It's give something with context. Have a way to make that customer feel like they're at ease, just like you would want to be on the opposing end, and make sure, hey, how do we deliver value now? Because they've come to us with a problem. We want to come with them with a solution and over deliver on that by saying, hey, we're caring about what's happening here in this moment.
It's brilliant. And as a service provider ourselves, 100% agree. We've taken a similar tact. We get a lot of emails in the course of our professional services. We use shout out to, if you're familiar with Front, it's a web-based front end that enables companies to manage multiple inboxes.
Okay.
It has a function in there where you can set SLAs. Our experience has been identical. If, and I think you said it really well. I mean, if we're if the roles are reversed, we want our vendors to be responsive. And
Right.
so if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And I think it demonstrates a level of commitment that you take the relationship seriously.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
So you mentioned AI earlier. I'd argue it's an industrial revolution, and we're probably in the early innings, and perhaps even the top of the first. But would love your perspective on how you think the technology is going to impact your space.
Yeah, I see it as augmentation, right? That's the way I truly see it. I think everyone's seen it, the balances of GPT doctor along the way. I can ask it questions, it's going to give me better responses. It's true, it very well may, but mind you, a lot of that information is all diagnostic information that it's using and pulling, right? And that's things from prior and predecessors and everything else. The objective, I think, that really you'll see in the healthcare space is can we take real-time information that's coming again from devices, from decisions, and start to use that to pragmatically give an augmented result of, hey, this is a possible trend that could be occurring. You should be able to detect an arrhythmia, let's say, right? This is futuresque for me. And I think we're not too far. And maybe the next coming years of we've got enough cardiac information that you should be able to detect a patient with an onset stroke, or with an onset ischemia or MI. And it's important because it doesn't take one parameter to figure that out. It's labs, it's respiratory, it's brain information. All of that together can help determine a trend and give you that kind of crossroad of, hey, this patient is trending here. There's an 80% chance that they could have a stroke because of X, Y, and Z. Providing that, right, to the clinician at that standpoint is insightful even in more details and data outside of just surface level, right? Surface level labs, surface level, just scans and views. We've brought it together and created a structured data set that you now can make a more advanced decision on, with again more details and insight. So for me, augmentation, I think you'll still always have a human in the loop in the healthcare space. But how do we help advance that and make the decision making pragmatic and then enhance precision medicine is the way I see it.
Well, I'm a betting man, and so I think I would bet on that. I agree 100%. Justin, it's been a great podcast, a ton of great insights. Before we wrap up, one of the questions I enjoy asking our guests is if you had an opportunity to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, however young they may be, what
Oh, that's a good one. That is a good one. I would tell myself, don't stop going through the unconventional hoops, right? That's what I would say. Because that's sometimes I think even myself, you just kind of fall into like, hey, like we've got to do it this way because everyone else is doing it this way. And it's not a don't go against the grain or break the status quo moment. But it really has been the tangents of the unconventional moments that we've had, even myself personally, that have put me in a spot where I was like, wow, I would have never thought of that or done this if I didn't take this tangent way. Again, call it the multiple startups along the way that we had. Some of those were during college, some of those were post-college, some of them we had no idea what we were doing, right? But each one of those were brought at unconventional times that gave me more insight to be where we're at today. And my co-founder says it the best, no matter what happens, if we make it or don't make it at this point, it's the furthest we've made it. And we should all be proud of that because that's the hardest part. It was to getting it this far.
I love it. That's great insight. I have a similar opinion. I think of sort of statistics. If you think of a normal distribution, if we make the decisions everybody else makes, why should we expect above average results?
Right.
So yes, I think the unconventional lies at the fat tails, and for whatever the reason, we could probably devote a podcast to it as well. People just don't necessarily want to operate there, but yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that's I think where all the fulfillment and excitement lie.
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure.
Good stuff. Well, hey, Justin, I appreciate having you on. If there are any listeners in our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
LinkedIn's always a great spot. I'll leave my contact information here too as well. But say always reach out once you see it. I'm happy to help and trying to handle all the fun stuff in healthcare, right? Make it a little less boring. Let's call it that.
Awesome. Love it. Well, again, for the benefit of our audience, Justin, thank you so much. Justin Ramsaran. Justin is a co-founder and CEO of R Group, also the vice president of digital health solutions at Fukuda Denshi. Justin, appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks here. I appreciate it as well. Thank you.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.